Good afternoon. Welcome to The Public Affair. My name is David Devereaux Weber. We've got a couple of things to talk about today. In the past, I've talked about the changes that are going on in media in general. And because of the internet, more and more resources are available to people. And so people use broadcast resources less than they used to. And they also use broadcast television less than they used to. But there are more choices out there. And one of the choices out there is to read blogs. Blog is a short term that was for weblog. And so there was a meeting the weekend before last, called Netroots Wisconsin, which is a group of bloggers who write blogs in the Wisconsin area. So, as our guest for the first part of the show today, we have Steve Hansen. Steve is the organizer of Netroots Wisconsin. Steve, are you with us?
I hope so.
Good. I can hear you there. That's a good thing. So, first of all, I wanted to thank you for organizing a great little conference, a one-day conference here in Madison. And I also want to thank you for being available on such short notice to talk about it. So tell us a little bit about how the term blog came about and a little bit about Netroots Wisconsin.
Okay, well, blog is basically short for weblog. It's just sort of a contraction. And there are a bunch of people throughout the state blogging about, you know, this, that, and the other thing. My particular interest all around progressive politics and journalism. And I found that, you know, for quite a few years now, I've had these online relationships with other bloggers and news media people around the state, many of whom I've never actually met, partly because I live way up here in northwestern Wisconsin, west of Eau Claire. And so I thought it would be great if we could kind of get together. And there have been a couple of these conferences now, well, actually two in the country. There are regional conferences of the national conference, which is Netroots Nation. And there was one in Minnesota last year, and I thought it would be great to have one in Wisconsin.
And I was one of the people who attended, and I'm really glad that you did that organization. There were a number of different sessions or panels, and I will be glad to chat with you a little bit about some of those panels. Maybe we should talk a little bit about the Netroots National grouping at first before we get into what we did in Wisconsin. Can you tell a little bit of the background about the National Netroots Conference and where that came from?
Sure. Netroots Nation is sort of an outgrowth of the national political blog Daily Kos, founded by Mark Oates Militsis. And the first year it was called Yearly Kos. But it's been going on for, I think, 6 years now. Next year it will be in Minneapolis, so it's back in the Midwest again. And it's great fun. You know, you get to meet all kinds of people who are involved in online activism of various kinds. You generally get to meet candidates, usually big national candidates and some local candidates. The last one I went to was in Chicago in 2007, and I got to actually meet all of the Democratic candidates for president. And so that's kind of a big thing, and this business of doing them regionally is very new. And in fact, I think none of us really know what's going to come from that. This was the first one in Wisconsin and only the second one in the country, so we're sort of feeling our way through it right now.
In my early days of radio, I worked in the Janesville radio station, WCLO, and one of the things I really enjoyed about working at WCLO, this was back in the 1960s, was the newsroom was right around the corner. And there was a teletype back in the old days, printing paper. It's so archaic now, but the teletype would be chunking along and typing story after story almost on a continuous basis. So even though the news wasn't on the air, once a program was on, and as an engineer, I didn't have to stay there every second, so I could wander over to the newsroom and see what story was coming across the teletype. Nowadays, the news that we see on television and the news that we hear on the radio has gotten less and less impressive. Less time is devoted to the news, less local news is happening both on television and radio, and the quality of reporting, in my humble opinion, has gone down. But what's coming to take its place is the blog. So one of the things that I found so exhilarating at the Netroots Wisconsin conference was the chance to meet some of the candidates. And I know that Russ Feingold was there and gave a tremendous presentation. Can you tell us a little bit about who else came?
Sure. Well, the candidate session was a really interesting project because it sort of all fell together at the absolute last minute since, all the candidates are really busy right now and they mostly just managed to make kind of a drive-by appearance at the conference. As you say, Russ Feingold was there, and actually his talk is up on our website right now if you want to go look at it at netrootswisconsin.org. We also had Tom Barrett, who is running for governor as a Democratic candidate, and we had Scott Hassett, who is running for attorney general. And so we had actually a pretty good mix of candidates. I'm amazed it all turned out and that they managed to not all arrive at the same time, so things were a little disorganized, but it worked fairly well.
What was thrilling to me was to get a chance at talking to these people directly and not in a large event where there were tens of thousands or hundreds of people, but in a much smaller venue. And they didn't speak to us in generalities. It was a much more specific and intelligent discussion, and I really enjoyed that.
So. They're all people who have actually had a pretty close relationship with Netroots people and bloggers in the state. Russ in particular has always been tied into that group of people, and we've had pretty good relationships. And, in fact, the bloggers around the state raised quite a lot of money for him during his big Cheddar Bomb event about few weeks ago, where we had our own webpage where people could donate to him, and we raised about $10,000 for him.
I think it was much more than that. So, at least in the total,
well, we raised about $10,000 for him. He raised more like $500,000 right, in aggregate from all the different sources, and this was all in one day.
So the area in which blogs exist, bloggers have called that the blogosphere. And in Wisconsin, of course, we have to localize it, and so it's called the Cheddar Sphere. So, and Russ's one-day fundraiser was called a Cheddar Bomb for some reason, but it was very online focused and just a one-day event, so it was very interesting. By the way, listeners, WORT has a drive coming up, so. If you're in the mind of thinking about driving for funds, October 17th through the 30th, and if you guys who are our listeners out there would like to help us out, sign up on our website of WORT-FM.org for shifts on that. The ideas that are happening in the internet and the blogosphere and the Cheddar Sphere are also trickling down into WORT. So. Your help would be appreciated. So tell us a little bit more about some of the other sessions that you had. I enjoyed the Sunlight Foundation presentation. Do you want to describe that, or I could describe it with you?
Well, actually, since I was busy running around at the conference all day, I actually got to sit in on remarkably few of the sessions. But we had two young women who came out from the Sunlight Foundation in Washington, and they gave talks about Different ways that you can incorporate their tools into your own blogs. They're doing a lot of really interesting programming projects out there, and one of them revolves around taking some of the tools that they've had for including government transparency information on websites and extending them down to the states. So I expect pretty soon now we're going to start having access to a lot more legislative information and that sort of thing and be able to incorporate it in our blogs. We're planning on doing that on my own group blog, Uppity Wisconsin, and I'm sure a lot of other bloggers around the state will do the same. So that was kind of an exciting bunch of talks, and it was very informative. I think we've gotten very complimentary results back from people on our participant survey.
A couple of directions I want to take the discussion in. One is, do you have a list on the Netroots Wisconsin webpage of other Wisconsin blogs?
We are working on that. I expect that will be up there in a database sometime in the next week or so. Frankly, everything ground to a halt in the last week before the conference, and so now I'm trying to catch up on some of these housekeeping tasks.
I understand.
We will have a blog roll there real soon now.
Do you have a blog roll on your blog, Uppity Wisconsin?
Yeah, we do. We have a website database that's available. There's a links database there, and we also do have... We carry some information from some of the other sites, and there is actually a small blog roll on Netroots Wisconsin right now. It just lists the latest content from the different blogs who actually presented at the conference, and we're going to extend that now and do something more interesting with it.
Let me explain to the listeners a little bit about the Sunlight Foundation. In an attempt to bring more information to users, they're doing something that I'll describe as kind of like Google. That is, they gather information and create references to get at that information so that plain citizens sitting at their computer at home, you don't have to be a reporter, you don't have to be a blogger, you can just be you. You can find out information about federal expenses, foreign lobbying, what senators and representatives, what earmarks that they put on legislation, what earmarks they get when legislation is passed, who contributes to their campaigns, all sorts of information so that you can take it upon yourself to learn more about the candidates for office and for your existing legislators. And it gives you a better idea of what's going on in Washington and what affects your taxes and what your government is doing. And it's not put out by the candidates or by the Congress or by the federal government. It's information that's made available by them, but then correlated and sorted and indexed by Sunlight Foundation and made available to us in order so that we can make better informed decisions in our elections and our day-to-day politics. Fascinating tools.
One of the things that's interesting what they're doing with that is they're making it available through an API so that other people can reuse that data and use it in different ways on websites or for whatever purpose. They also do some really interesting stuff with mobile applications. They have a really neat phone application where you can go and look at all kinds of information about Congress people and status of federal bills and that sort of thing.
I've got another guest to bring on, so I'd like to thank you very much for your help on this. It's been really fascinating. We've been talking to Steve Hansen, who organized the Netroots Wisconsin conference, and thanks very much, Steve.
Thank you for having me.
Okay. Another presenter at the Netroots Wisconsin panel talked about all sorts of resources for doing research. So you can do research on candidates for office. For instance, you can look at court data and see if people have been sued or people have liens against them or things like that. There's the classic resources like Lexis and ProQuest and newspapers, websites themselves. So when you're trying to find out who to vote for, or if a candidate has a problem, or if somebody accuses a candidate of something and you want to do research, you have all these tools available to you to do your own research to find out whether their claims have any basis or not. Another panel we had was discussion of how to use social networking tools like Facebook and so on to promote issues. Facebook has become a widely used tool, and it's fairly easy to set up web pages for issues and organize a page around an issue. So we're going to join another guest right now. And Norm Stockwell has joined us, and we're going to try to do a phone interview. So go ahead.
Hi, Dave. Thanks for having me on here as well. And we're very pleased to have with us by telephone Michael Franti, who's joining us just for a very short bit of time. But Michael Franti is playing at the Overture Center this October 9th at the Capitol Theater, a show that starts at 8 p.m. Saturday, October 9th.
Listeners have heard his work fairly frequently here on WORT at the start of every public fair show.
That's right. As a matter of fact, Michael, your song, Listener Supported, off the Stay Human album, is the theme song for this very program that that you're listening to right now. I wanted to start by just talking about your new album, Sound of Sunshine, which has just come out. In fact, it was just released exactly a week ago, and is already doing very well. It's a AAA charting hit. And tell us a little bit about the album, Sound of Sunshine.
Well, I recorded it starting last year. We were out on tour with Counting Crows, and in the middle of the tour, my appendix ruptured, and I developed a very bad infection throughout my whole abdomen, and became very, very, very ill. And after they performed surgery on me, and as I was fighting off the infection, I was in the hospital, and I felt so grateful to be alive. And every day I'd go to the curtain and I'd peel back the curtain a little bit and I'd see if the sun was shining outside. And if it was, I'd get this incredible feeling of optimism and hope. And I thought, wow, if I could bottle that sensation, what would it sound like? And so I set out to write all these songs that were about gratitude for the simple things in life that we often overlook. Like, I remember one morning in the hospital just eating this orange and watching the juice dripped down my arm and feeling like, wow, I'm so lucky to have this orange and my family and my friends nearby. And that's what this album is really all about.
You know, all of your stuff, I think, really is about celebrating the possibility of change and the world that might be. And you did a very interesting project a few years ago where you traveled around to Iraq and Palestine and produced a video documentary, I Know I'm Not Alone. And tell us just a little bit about the feeling of that project going to those war-torn areas as you did.
Well, when I went there, I had just gotten tired of listening to the news every night and watching generals and politicians explain, you know, the economic cost and political cost of war and never mentioning the human effect that war has. And so I took my guitar and a video camera and I went out to the streets of Baghdad and I played music there. I went to the Gaza Strip and throughout Israel and played music on the streets there. And then I would just talk to people about their life and videotape them. And they would tell me their stories. And it was really changing for me because I thought when I came back that I was going to write, you know, a dozen angry songs speaking out against war. But something happened to me on the streets of Baghdad. I'd play these political songs, and people would say, you know, that's a really nice sentiment, but play something that makes us laugh and dance and sing. And so I would, and I realized that, you know, music might not change the world overnight, but it helps us make it through, it can help someone make it through a difficult night. And that's what really my goal is today. I don't write as directed political songs as I once did, but my passion and commitment to social change is greater than ever off of or outside of music. You know, I traveled to East Timor recently and was playing music there and did a little film about my experience there. And on this tour, we partnership with this organization called Souls for Souls, and we're raising 100,000 pairs of shoes on our tour for people in natural disasters or who have never worn shoes around the world. And so we're always trying to find new ways to become more involved in the world that we have around us.
We're speaking by telephone with Michael Franti, who's performing next Saturday, October 9th, at the Capitol Theater of the Overture Center. And you can contact them for ticket information. Michael Franti's song, Listener Supported, the theme song for this program, A Public Affair, that you're listening to right now. And Michael, I know we only have a few minutes with you on this time on the phone here, but I wanted to ask, you know, looking at your MySpace page, michaelfranti.com, that's your website, michaelfranti.com. Your MySpace page has the new album, Sound of Sunshine. The title track has about 32,000 plays, but your song, Say Hey, I Love You, has over 4 million plays, and in fact, it made a top 40 hit. And I wonder if you could talk for just a second about how it feels to have a foot in both worlds, to be an alternative artist, a progressive artist, and yet also be doing these top 40 songs and getting your music on television programs like Weeds and things like that.
Well, to me, it's really great because it gives me an opportunity to reach people that I never had before, you know. And, you know, it's always, for 20 years, it's always been a great complaint of mine and a lot of people, is that you don't hear these voices in the mainstream. And so, you know, now we have people coming to our shows who just heard that one song, and then they come and they hear shows like Listener Supported or Y'all Fire or Tolerance or any number of songs that are have, you know, powerful messages in them, and they come and they dance and they're inspired by them. And I remember being a kid and you know, growing up in a relatively small town and hearing The Clash for the first time. And it was the song Rock the Casbah, and it came over the radio. It's just a pop song in amongst all the others. And then I bought their album and was learned about the Sandinistas, and I learned about what was happening in Nicaragua and all these different places in the world that I had never even heard of before. Just all through their music, I became so aware socially. And I think that that's, you know, one of the great powers of pop music, is that it invites people to see and hear things that maybe they wouldn't if it weren't for, you know, that initial song that they first heard on the radio.
Michael Franti, we've just passed the anniversary of September 11th, and of course you do a peace festival, a festival of music that you were doing before September 11th. You have continued to do since then. I think in 2008 you had like 50,000 people attending. What is your hope for peace in the world in spite of things that are happening like September 11th?
Well, I really believe that when people have a roof over their heads, they have food in their belly, they have a decent job, and they have access to education, that they're far less likely to strap a bomb on their body and walk into a supermarket. And I've seen that firsthand, you know, traveling to the countries where, you know, like Iraq and like Palestine. And I really believe that if we want to make serious change in the world in terms of political violence, that we have to start listening to the needs of people and helping people create lives that that they want to continue living. And so that's really what my goal is with our festival. We do it every year on September 11th, and it's a free festival. This year we had over 80,000 people attend. We bring together over 100 different social justice organizations, everything from environmental issues to homelessness to veterans to youth gang prevention. And we plug people in and we say, oh, a great way to remember September 11th is by volunteering to make the world a better place. And so we get people plugged into these different ways that they can help.
Great. Well, Michael Franti, thank you so much for joining us. Looking forward to seeing you in the Capitol Theater of the Overture Center on Saturday, October 9th, 8 p.m. show. And thank you so much for joining us here on WORT, listener-sponsored community radio.
You're welcome. Take care.
Bye now.
Thanks very much, Norm. Thanks, Michael. One of the issues we've been talking about in the last few shows that I've done here is the network neutrality issue. One of my correspondents sent me a question by tweet about what rights need to be protected from curtailment by network providers. I have kind of a different take on network neutrality, and I'm not sure of the necessity of network neutrality, and I know that a lot of people disagree with me, and some quite strongly on that. But I think that the background for why I'm thinking what I'm thinking is the changes that I see coming. The technology that provides the internet, especially over fiber optics, is growing by leaps and bounds, and it's affected by what's known as Moore's Law. So as time goes by, the people who design those integrated circuits make them better, faster, and cheaper, which means more bandwidth can be sent over fiber optic lines. Dial-up telephone lines of the internet, or even DSL lines, are limited by the physics of being the twisted pair copper, and so don't have the ability to keep increasing bandwidth. So unless somebody changes the technology to using something like fiber optics, these effects don't happen. But if they do, then you can provide bandwidth at ever-decreasing costs to customers of internet services like schools or even homes if you do fiber optic to the home. So I'm looking forward to seeing fiber optic to the home from a Madison carrier or two in the near future. So in answer to that question, I wouldn't actually ask for protection by network providers about that because of the changes that we see happening. One effect of the changes that we've seen happening is in the number of people who have telephones using wireline phones. I've been in the same house for 35 years, and so I haven't had need to disconnect my phone. But people who move from time to time, for instance, students or people who are affected by the rental market, they move rather frequently, sometimes once a year. And when you have to wait for a telephone to be installed, and then you first of all have to wait to be placed on the schedule. Sometimes it's a day or two, sometimes it's a week or two. And then you have to wait for a four-hour period for the person to show up and connect the wires and so on. So cellular telephones have been very popular because you don't have to wait. You just go to the cellular telephone shop and pick up your phone. So as a result, if you look at the demographics of the situation, people who live in rental housing or young people who are students use wireline telephones less frequently. And so if you look at the statistics by telephone companies, there are fewer and fewer wireline phones around. There are many more cell phones. So we have a call. Go ahead, caller. You're on the air.
Hi. Good afternoon. I agree with you completely, except for one thing. One, I live 25 miles from Madison. It's 18, but the roads are long. And what makes you think that the companies would ever play fair? So if you have four or five companies that are providing stuff, let's just make them up using names, AT&T, which is now Zingular, and you've got, somebody else doing it. Why would they play fair with, let's say, What Radio versus some paid show with some shock jock that talks on the satellite?
Excellent question. And I don't think that... first one, factual correction. Singular is now AT&T, I think, isn't it? But anyway, Singular used to be owned by two different companies, one of which was AT&T, and then they bought the other company and turned Singular back into AT&T Wireless or AT&T, whatever. First of all, it's difficult to not play fair on the internet if we're talking about internet-type services. It is possible, but it takes a lot of effort to favor one service over another, or one type of content over another. The routers
service the, exists most of the very large routers.
Go ahead.
Cisco. So I could just say, I want quality of service for my downloaded movies, because I'm being paid for those, to run at a higher something than somebody who's using YouTube or somebody that's just, you know, cruising the net. When I, let's say that's political, we build a filter and we say, you know, I really don't like Republicans, so I'm going to kind of pinch anything that looks like it might be Fox or something like that, and I'll just give them a slightly less quality of service and no one will know. And that way my streaming stuff, which I'm being paid for, is going to get you know, a higher quality of service and fewer dropouts and so on. So,
well, let's talk a little bit about we'll pick on AT&T. They have a service called UVerse, and in the UVerse service, you get a television service that's similar to cable television. It's aggregated by AT&T and presented to you as a television service. And they use IP transport just like the internet does, but it's a totally separate network. So they are treating you unfairly. Their IP signals get a much higher quality than the internet, and it's guaranteed because that's how they deliver their service. But it's a television service, and so you would expect that. If you look at dealing with the internet itself, it's not easy to find out what kind of content, for instance, is it conservative, is it liberal, is it Fox, or is it CNN? You could favor CNN's IP addresses or Fox's IP addresses, but that gets difficult. Only if it was pretty lucrative would a carrier like AT&T or Charter or Time Warner or Verizon or somebody else go through the effort to do that. And then furthermore...
And I don't have fiber optics. It's about three-quarters of a mile through here and goes up to a small town. And I would have to whistle for a long time before they'd bring me fiber optics to my door.
Understood.
That's one thing. And I have a pretty nice service right now, but if I want greater bandwidth, I've got to pay more money. It's DSL over the phone lines. So, again, if I'm some internet service provider, and just make up one, will be, you know, Apple. Oh, sorry, that's a company.
Acme.
We'll be Pear.
Remember Acme?
Pear is your internet service provider, and you pay them so much money to give you internet access. So you go out to something. Could be AT&T, could be a different phone company, because I'm not really AT&T out here. And that company has limited bandwidth on their trunk. They do. They have limited bandwidth. And I'm sitting here on a phone line, and I've had them come out a couple of times to make adjustments. They could just say, at some router, wherever that router would be, could be anywhere, but typically it'd be within a couple of miles, let's say, quality of service limits these addresses. These, I'm not going to do a .net. I'm going to only do .com or vice versa. I'm only going to do people inside of the U.S. I'm only going to do paid-for services. And therefore, everybody on that trunk line, my eight neighbors, let's say, see something slightly different than if you've got open total bandwidth. I just sorry to disagree. I just was thinking about this. And I said, why would they play fair? Why would they ever? There's always going to be a reason.
The reason that they would play fair is the fear that a competitor would come along and say, we offer service without filtering or quality of service, where we benefit one kind of website over another.
But I only have one company here. I only have, there's nothing else. There's no cable. There's only the phone line. The phone line is not AT&T. It was one of those tricks they did so that from Madison you can call Middleton and you can call Sun Prairie for free, but I can't. So I'm in that different LAT.
Okay.
I think that once they start doing this at the small level and at the large level, so whoever you're thinking about, like it could be Google, it could be AT&T, it could be any company, why would you ever think that they would have a level playing field for anybody else? There's always going to be some gotcha, and now we've legalized the gotchas.
Well, a number of things. It's a good discussion. It's never been illegal to favor one internet source over another. The action that recently happened with Google and Verizon was they agreed to put a proposal out to the world that had that was not binding to anybody. It was just their suggestion about how things should be regulated. The FCC didn't adopt anything yet, including their plan. There's no current rule on the books that says an internet service provider has to be fair in the first place. Then it is possible with cellular telephones, it's also possible to get a card that goes into your computer where you can get internet service over the cellular data plan. And there are multiple cellular providers out there in terms of companies like Sprint or TDS or AT&T. So in that world, there is competition. You're right. In terms of the wireline service to your home, there's only one provider right now. And but in the wireless world, there might be other alternatives for you. And the companies that provide the wireline service realize that risk is there, and they're losing customers because of it.
Right now, I can use wireless. I could get on that, but I'd have to pay anytime minutes. I do have unlimited download, and I'm going to keep it. But again, there's only one cell tower that I can get to because I've tried other ones. So I'm stuck in the Zingular world. So I'm an AT&T guy currently.
Mm-hmm.
I have no choice. There's nothing within 5 to 8 miles of here that would give me the other kind of wireless. Now, there might be in the future, but I live in Columbia County, and the population of Columbia County is smaller than the population of the number of undergraduate students at the University of Wisconsin. So it's a little different when you live in the country, and that's why I'm concerned, because there are no alternatives. There is no competition. Now, that's not to say that there might not be in the future, but right now there isn't. I could do the Dish Network. I could add another $100 a month to the service plans that I use. But that's about it. I mean, there just isn't anything else.
I appreciate your situation, and thanks for calling.
Well, thanks much.
And if I, keep listening, and we'll keep talking about this on my shows every other Friday, and we'll see if we can find other alternatives for you. There are other wireless internet service providers. The acronym WISP, W-I-S-P, has been assigned to those, and there are people in south of Madison that use a technology that they put up on trees or silos or barns or whatever, and then hop from access point to access point and offer a wireless service in competition with both the cellular world and the wired telephone world and the satellite world. So the competition thing is one thing that will help. The other thing is that I would like to see more people go back to the idea of forming a telephone co-op. A co-op is owned by its members, and while it's very expensive for an individual to put fiber to their home, once you form a co-op and share that cost, it makes it more possible. And there also are loans available sometimes at the federal level at very low interest rates, which would allow you to finance something like this over time. That's how your phone company probably started 40, 50, 70 years ago, whatever. So hopefully that can happen again. The number here at WORT is 256-2001. My background for this networking stuff is I work at the University of Wisconsin as a network engineer there, and we are in an urban area, and we are in a situation where we have access to several companies' fiber networks, and we've even built our own fiber network. I've tried to get AT&T on the show to talk about their opinions about what's going on in the marketplace and their thoughts about networking in Wisconsin, and hopefully we can get them on sometime in the future. The situation with networking, when you can have the fiber optic transmission, allows you to increase bandwidth. We talked about the broadband technical opportunities grants that were made available from the federal government, from the National Telecommunications Information Institute or something like NTIA. One of those grants has been made available to the organization known as Internet 2. Internet 2 will be increasing its bandwidth to member universities from 10 gigabits per second to 100 gigabits per second. So it's 10 times the bandwidth. Universities and research institutions will have access to a lot more bandwidth. This will be made available to the statewide network that we call WISCNET, and WISCNET is a provider to educational and research institutions. So many libraries and school systems in cities and counties can be members of WISCNET and are members of WISCNET. So that increased bandwidth will become available to those places. So one of the technologies that's available out there is, for instance, for the court system to put the results of cases that they hear on the internet. The increased bandwidth available through WISCNET, through cities and counties, makes that information available to us more quickly, and more people can use it, and we all become more informed because of it. One of the resources out there is a company called CourtDataTech.com, and they take information from the courts and collate it and sort it and make it available to people so that you can more easily use it. There are a number of other places where you can get information like this. There's a website called PACER, which is an acronym for Public Access to Court Electronic Records. And that address is pacer.gov. But there are many other state and federal and local ways to look up information. That information is useful to you if you're looking about how political candidates are working out, or when you're applying for a job at a company, it's fairly certain that that company is using those kind of technologies to look up information about you. One of the things that we constantly warn young people is to be careful about what they post on Twitter or Facebook or MySpace or those social networking sites, because things like that live on forever. Even searches that you do on Google are kept by Google forever. They look at trends in searching, and that tells them what's going on. And other people can use those trends as well. One application that I heard of some time ago was health authorities can tell when colds are breaking out in a community, or when the flu is breaking out in a community, because of searches that are done on the various search engines for symptoms of cold or flu or remedies for those things. We have a caller. Go ahead, caller.
Is that me?
Yes.
Yeah, I would say about 2 years ago, I had a discussion with a friend about the end of the internet and the idea that since everything is becoming mobile, web browsers would just disappear and vaporize, and search engines as well, which is our thinking that Google moved over to phones really quickly. And then it turns out now in the September issue of Wired Magazine, lo and behold, the cover story is saying the web is dead, and I was wondering if you could comment on that story.
Yes, that was an attention grabber, wasn't it? Thanks for calling. The story was that rather than using a general purpose application like a web browser, that more and more special purpose applications are being written. It's especially true on the handheld devices like iPhones and iPads and iPods and Android phones and so on. So rather than just use an internet browser to go to the Facebook website, you get a Facebook application that does that for you. Or if you use the Huffington Post as a source for news, or if you use the New York Times or many others, you can get applications that were crafted by those people. Wired magazine itself has got a Wired magazine application, and not only does it have the entire contents of each issue, but it also has the ability to play multimedia, audio and video clips as well. Now, Wired Magazine actually charges for each issue of Wired Magazine that's available through their application on the iPad. Another special purpose application are the readers like Kindle. There are a number of readers like Kindle that allow you to read books on either your computer or your handheld device. Kindle is also the name of a hardware handheld device itself. So the Web is Dead article is about the change from the general purpose internet browser to a more specific purpose application designed for a particular reason. The whole concept, though, of the internet being dead is I don't think true in the big picture. When you're using a handheld device or a portable device, it goes back to a wireless tower somewhere, probably pretty close. But then from that wireless tower, we use internet to go back to the nearest large city and from there onto the network of the provider. So AT&T has their network and Sprint has their network and Quest and so on all have their own private networks. And then in large cities like in Chicago and Los Angeles and New York, all those networks find places to peer with each other so that if I'm on AT&T's network and you're on Sprint's network, I can send you email, and it crosses over from the AT&T network to the Sprint network and then goes from